Welcome to another Emerging Cricket Podcast. We begin with some somber news to begin this show, which is broken after recording. Kaya Arua, all-rounder of the Papua New Guinea women's team, has died in hospital, aged 33. All-rounder Arua first appeared for PNG at the East Asia Pacific Trophy back in 2010 in Japan. Arua took the captaincy of PNG in a match against Ireland at the 2018 T20 World Cup qualifier before being named in the ICC Women's Global Development Squad in the same year. Arua took the captaincy on a permanent basis at the 2019 East Asia Pacific T20 World Cup qualifier, helping her side take the sole double qualification spot for both the 2019 ICC Women's T20 World Cup qualifier and the 2021 Women's Cricket World Cup qualifier tournaments. Our condolences go to her family and those at Cricket PNG. Coming up on this week's Emerging Cricket Podcast, status gate of the African Games, the retirement of Colin Dabuya, Challenge League groups, issues for Ireland and much more. Stick around. It's a warm welcome in again to the Emerging Cricket Podcast. Wherever you do get your podcasts, it's a hello from myself, Daniel Peswick, as well as Nick Skinner, testing ourselves here with the time zones once again and throwing another spanner in the works from my current whereabouts. But first to you, Nick, we should probably warn people before this episode begins, this podcast does not have T20i status, okay? Just letting everyone know, as disappointing it is as it is, and it'll be our first...
We've written to the ICC to complain about our status.
Yeah, because Tim's not playing in this podcast this week, decided to revoke this one as a T20i.
Dear idea.
Anyway, pat on the back for our own little gag there, Nick. But how's things in Europe at the moment?
Yeah, I'm all right. The day's getting longer. I'm looking at a lovely blue sky. I got my cup of tea here. Here they have a special word called Glückgewitter, which is window weather, where it's beautiful and blue and lovely outside, but it's actually quite cold, so you don't really want to go outside. You can just sit there and look at it from the window.
Sounds like Tasmania.
Yeah, actually, yeah, I can see that. But I think you've got some outside weather where you are, right? You're on holiday.
Oh, I do. I can confirm I've booked a spontaneous trip to Bali and I'm currently staying in one of the resorts here. At the time of recording, I'll probably be home by the time this is published, just a cheeky little week away, which has been much needed, and also celebrated my cousin's wedding actually in Mudgee in the weekend prior to flying here. I was lucky to be a groomsman of my cousin Andrew's wedding. Andrew is a journalist who works in Canberra and keeps our government at bay and serves a democratic function in Australia's capital. So congratulations to him and Mairead for their wedding. It was brilliant and Mudgee, and it helps. Mairead's mum is a well-known sort of florist in the Mudgee area, and so she knew a lot of the contacts, and I'm sure they had a lot of sort of good relationships going into the wedding, and they were able to organise a number of things relatively easily. And yeah, brilliant night. I'm glad to be a groomsman. Someone that I've known for, you know, my whole life, basically. My cousin, he's only a year younger than me. So when we grew up, our grandmother on mum's side, she basically dressed us in the same gift every year because we were about the same size. So you can go back and find all these family photos of me and him basically wearing the same shirts and pants. And our first memory was actually, the first memory that I can remember of Andrew, we were actually watching the torch relay for the Sydney Olympics. Oh. Before the start. We were on, I think it was Ryde Road, in the very close build up to Sydney 2000. And yeah, we have a lot in common. You know, he just appeared on another game show in Australia. I think that's his third appearance on a different game show in the country. So he's got me there 3-1. But yeah, we've got a lot in common. And yeah, he works in the media as well. And I suppose we bounce off each other a lot when we get the chance to see each other. So yeah, congratulations to him. And yeah, after that, decided just to hop on a plane and found myself at a resort here in Nusa Dua for 6 days or so. And yeah, the time has flown, unfortunately, and flying back on the Friday night to get in on the Saturday morning. So not looking forward to go back. It's been enjoyable. But there was a lot of cricket that happened in the last week, and I'm glad we've got the chance to sit down and record again. And it must be noted, it's been a really busy, I suppose, 2 weeks of Emerging Cricket podcast content, you know, between us and Nate Naman with Big Innings as well It's been an eventful 10 days. And again, it's worth reiterating that there's plenty in the back catalogue if you haven't heard it already. Wherever you are listening to your podcast, it might be Apple, Spotify, Google, Amazon. I don't know where you are, but thank you for where you are listening, not only physically, but on the platform that you so choose. Make sure to give us a 5-star rating. I suppose it gives us a nice little boost heading and trying to be as popular as we can in the cricket community, telling these associate cricket stories. This associate story is one that I think has marred what could have been a great tournament. Unfortunately, I suppose the results on the field probably not as close as we would have liked at the African Games, but they would have taken a backseat anyway after the complete debacle that was Statusgate here at this tournament. We believed, or it was claimed, that there was T20i status throughout this competition. It seems nothing was ever really set in stone from a competition or ICC perspective. And mysteriously, halfway through, fittingly when South Africa's team managed to drop points, they decided that, no, hang on a second. We're not going to have T20i status for these matches because we've sent what they then called the University 11. And it was then withdrawn from Zimbabwe matches afterwards. And there's still inconsistencies across the different platforms where people get their scorecards. And we need to remember too that centres, namely, you know, CricInfo and CricBuzz, while they do a really good job of recording and stats keeping and all of that, and they're to be commended for that, they're not the websites of record here, so you can't really take what they do as gospel either. We found out roughly halfway through the tournament that Cricket South Africa had sent a letter to the ICC requesting that the matches would be denounced as T20Is, which was a little bit unfortunate because we saw a few, you know, really good performances from some of the South African kids who will now have those matches not count towards their T20i records. There was seemingly no clarification before the tournament, and there's kind of two points to this. Is one is that, you know, universal status has really helped grow the game in these regions where you get some names up in lights and you get new heroes created. And secondly, and probably most importantly, as much as we don't like it, the T20i rankings go a long way to dictating future places in global tournaments. We know that the rankings will dictate spots of the next men's T20i World Cup after a cutoff date here before the T20 World Cup that's scheduled in June. And we know, talking to Bertus de Jong, who's looked at these rankings infinitum, that, well, the difference between a lot of the sides on the bubble of potential qualification for the T20 World Cup, there are several teams battling it out to try and gain automatic places, which means that, you know, matches in the US and the Caribbean will go a long way to deciding them as well. It seems all a little bit murky. We're not too sure how it's going to play out from a rankings perspective in terms of global tournaments, but this is a real problem in our game, Nick, and we could talk forever about it, and not a whole lot probably changes, but it's worth just acknowledging that it becomes really murky what the ICC actually does and how the ICC actually works, which is a conversation point that comes up not only here, but a little bit later on in the pod when we talk about fake news and, you know, news misquoted and ICC sources being misquoted. This has all been a real problem this week. And to be honest, it's not been a particularly enjoyable time in emerging cricket spheres having to read all of this and wasting our breath on a point that and a topic that we shouldn't need to be talking about this. But unfortunately, we are, because quite frankly, it's going to be important down the line of T20i rankings and just the exposure and status of these matches and what it means for international cricket.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on here. I think the point about the ICC's function is an interesting one because, I mean, thinking to the status point and the, you know, Cricket Archive and Crick Info, a lot of the time, sort of the ICC's stats and, you know, their match center and whatnot, because they've kind of hollowed out the organization so much, you know, they've basically outsourced all of their functions to Crick Info or Cricket Archive or whoever.
Or, yes, I think it's Sport Radar that currently has it, or is it Sports? It might be Sports Interactive now, actually.
Yeah, I mean, you'd know more than me on the specifics, but they have not done much of this in-house for a long time, which means basically then now they're kind of at the whims of these private companies and what, you know, they happen to determine is status. And I mean, determining status of international cricket is like one of the ICC's few, or in theory, independent functions that they can actually decide. So, you know, we were told before the tournament started that the matches would be T20i status holding. And then, you know, halfway through the tournament, the men's tournament, you know, this is well after the women's tournament even finished. So I think that's kind of a little point that shows, well, maybe CSA, were they not paying attention to the women's tournament? Did they not care if the women's tournament would have status? And then they kind of had to backtrack when the men's team embarrassed them with losing to Kenya. I don't know what was happening there. But so the fact that, you know, we were told before the tournament started that they would have status, and then at some point CSA apparently got unhappy with it. You know, the reporting we've seen from, you know, from Crick Info and others is that CSA were basically promised that the team wouldn't have status and it would be an A team or an emerging team. Or I think what they ended up doing was they sent the winner of the university, you know, the South African university competition, which I think I'm all for that. You know, I think that's a great opportunity for those guys, and, you know, it made the tournament more exciting. And it, you know, it was just a fun little story in Byplay that, oh yeah, Kenya recorded their first victory against South Africa. Like, everyone knew that it was a much weaker South African team, and it's not necessarily representative of the two countries' level. But even within that, it's a nice little story in the course of the tournament. And then, yeah, I guess somebody at CSA noticed that these teams were being awarded status and they didn't like it, and they kind of stepped in to force the ICC to withdraw the status. I don't know what happened with Zimbabwe. We haven't seen much reporting on whether Zimbabwe contacted the ICC or if the ICC sort of took it upon themselves to delist the Zimbabwe matches. Strangely, the Namibian matches don't seem to have been delisted, which, I mean, considering Namibia also sent, you know, a development squad where, you know, looking at that team in the final, for example, like maybe one or two would be selected in a full strength 11. So, like, you know, Namibia obviously had a much weaker team as well. So if you're going to say, oh, you know, these were development 11s, they shouldn't really count, well, why does Namibia's matches still count? Namibia thought their matches would count and they still sent a development team. I don't know. It's really a mess here. You know, if CSA were promised beforehand that they could send an A team and then the matches still had status, I guess that's an oversight. So, you know, fair enough on one level that they complained. But we're seeing from that reporting that they didn't want to send a team in the first place. And they sort of, the CSA basically had to be talked into it by the government to be a, you know, responsible regional neighbor in the African Games and participate in this stuff. So, yeah, I don't know. It's all very strange. I don't think CSA's attitude is particularly positive here. It certainly shows they've got a pretty low opinion of the tournament. Well, you know, at first they don't want to even bother sending a team, and if they do send a team, they can't handle if the team loses, and they don't want to mess up their stats. I don't know. I mean, why are we being so precious about the stats? This is a recurring issue in cricket. On a more broad level, you know, it's a total disregard for the ICC's efforts in the region and what they're trying to do by getting cricket into the African Games, you know, giving it more of a profile. This is a region where cricket is growing. We're seeing a lot of cricket in Africa from several sort of hubs. Obviously, Rwanda hosts a lot of cricket. Uganda's getting better. Kenya, I mean, they've been on the downswing, but they did just beat a obviously weak South African team. You know, this is good for the game, and it's in South Africa's interest, you would think, to have a strong regional cricket scene, because, you know, they are so reliant on foreign tours for income, and if they're struggling to make ends meet from their sort of usual schedule, you know, if you have a strong regional cricket scene where people are willing to play and watch cricket all around Africa, that helps CSA in the long run. So they should be all on board with the ICC's attempts to promote the game. So I don't know. It doesn't really make sense on a lot of levels. Why were they so desperate to send a development 11 rather than just call it a South Africa? Like, I don't see the value of that. There's no chance that they can miss out on qualification for 2026 on the rankings. So yeah, again, they're just being precious about their stats. And, you know, Andrew Nixon made the point that universal status has kind of taken us back to the future a little bit in terms of, you know, back in the 20s or whatever, you would have the MCC sending teams to multiple places at once and calling them test matches. And, you know, last year, I think it was last year, the Maldives played two T20Is.
Yep, on the same day, yeah.
The Maldives are not exactly a strong team to start with. A few years back, we saw Turkey be on the receiving end of a lot of unwanted records because their team touring Europe was, a bunch of the guys had visa problems. So they had to cobble together an 11 of, guys who weren't really expecting to play, including, I think it was including the physio, right? So, those stats still count, but people just are able to put them in context. And, this was a very weak Turkish team. The Czech Republic, who put up record totals against them, aren't necessarily a fantastic team. It's just that they were playing a very weak team. People are able to put these stats in context. And, what is the danger of there being an interesting little, stats nugget somewhere hidden in the record books that South Africa lost to Kenya at the African Games? I mean, I don't really understand what CSA is losing. So, it just seems unfortunately petty, I guess, that they stepped in this way to make sure that their record wasn't sullied or whatever. And looking at the ICC's position in all of this, it really just highlights how powerless they are as an organization, that they try and make a decision about status, and then one of the full members has a whinge, and then they have to revoke it because the full members actually call the shots at the ICC.
Well, I'm glad that's how you kind of ended that, because in the cricket community and in the associate cricket community as fans, a lot of people have a different understanding of what the ICC actually is, in that, in theory, it serves as a body to serve its members rather than to be this overarching governing body that is allowed to make these wide-sweeping decisions, because ultimately it's the members that vote on everything and dictate the decisions that are made. And we'll talk about it a little bit later on with the stuff coming out of Nepal, but there were some fake quotes attributed to the ICC chairman, Greg Barclay, who said that in 2027, there will definitely be two new full members. And, that's great. Everyone has a sing and dance about it on Twitter for 5 minutes until someone realizes that, one, the quote never really happened and he was misquoted, and two, it's not really a case of a chairman making a wide sweeping declaration of two new full members to simply magically bring this into existence. It comes down to a members vote, and that's how Ireland and Afghanistan were brought in as full members. And looking back on that, whether or not the members did their due diligence in awarding Afghanistan full membership, well, that's a whole different can of worms. But again, it goes back to, what is the ICC? You would think that the ICC would have some sway on which matches do have international status, but it seems as if Cricket South Africa didn't really want to send a team in the first place, and then reluctantly did, and then felt the need to bring this forward. And I suppose, the argument, to the ICC is like, well, look, these are not our best players. It's never actually written in an African Games handbook that these matches have T20I status. Ergo, you can retrospectively go back and take them away. But it just ends in this murkiness. And once again, it reinforces the point. We've brought this up and we've talked about this for 10 minutes. And we haven't even talked about, the action that happened on the field in large part. Namibia's match is still counting as T20Is, even though they only sent, half a squad. I mean, JJ Smith just got married and he's off in Mauritius on his honeymoon. Congratulations, JJ, by the way.
Wow, congratulations.
He wasn't there. Malin Kruger was the captain in Namibia. Gerard Erasmus stayed home. Number of guys sat out this tournament. But to look at the actual competition on the field, Namibia and Zimbabwe on the men's side moved into the final. Uganda fell in the semi-finals, losing to Namibia, which was a little bit surprising because they'd beaten better Namibian sides in the past. And then Uganda actually turned around and walloped Kenya for bronze. We saw the announcement of Colin Dabuya retiring, and we'll probably gush over him in a few moments' time after, such an outstanding career and a widely respected emerging cricket international career, might add. But we'll talk about the winners in Zimbabwe first of all, who, as we mentioned, had sent, a pretty strong team in the grand scheme of things. We know that, they haven't got a T20 World Cup to worry about moving forward. They did leave a couple of guys out. It was sort of an under-25-ish type of squad that they sent. But overall, were pretty comfortable winners, really, especially in the final, where they were just too good for Namibia.
Yeah, it's interesting to see a few guys who've been kind of on the fringes of Zimbabwe selection get a go. And again, this is a good thing. This is what made this tournament interesting, was seeing some new players. And it speaks pretty well to Zimbabwe's depth, although it is kind of hard to judge because they didn't come up against, you know, a particularly good opposition. You're beating a weak Namibia side twice. I guess you can say that maybe Namibia's bench strength isn't quite as good as Zimbabwe's from that. But yeah, I mean, you know, guys like Jonathan Campbell and Brian Bennett, who've been there or thereabouts, Clive Madunde, who's been kind of in and out of the senior team, you know, a couple of the bowlers. Owen Mazondo was interesting to see him. The openers, Mupfudza and Maramani, who, yeah, again, they've had a couple of opportunities. So yeah, an interesting squad, and they played very well, and it'll bode well for, you know, for their bench strength. Jonathan Campbell had an interesting quote when Zimbabwe took on Kenya, and you know, his father Alistair Campbell's last ODI appearance had been against a Kenya team that included Collins Buya, so you know, really spanning the generations there. But yeah, I think a good outing for Zimbabwe, and it was a really entertaining tournament. I mean, if we're talking about what's been going on the field, I mean, yeah, there were some close matches that. Uganda beating the South African team on the last ball with a six, that was fun. Nigeria beating Namibia on the last ball with a six, that was great. So yeah, some really enjoyable results. Obviously, yeah, Namibia ended up pumping Tanzania to squeeze into the semi-finals, and yeah, that match against Uganda was a bit strange, wasn't it? Because this is a very weak Namibian team, and Uganda have beaten Namibia a couple of times in recent years when they've toured, and I don't believe any of them were official T20Is or ODIs or List A's or anything, but they were relatively strong Namibian 11s with significantly more of the kind of regular senior guys in them. And yeah, I mean, Uganda just were strangled in that chase. I think, you know, looking at this University South African 11 or whatever it was, you could probably make the case that South Africa underestimated the level of quality available in Africa. Obviously, they pumped Ghana, but then they lost pretty comfortably to Kenya. And yeah, last ball match against Uganda. Roger Mukasa for Uganda was very good throughout the tournament.
Yeah.
So I've really, ever since he's come up to open, I think he's been a lot better. It seems to have really suited him. And I like seeing him going hard at the top of the order. So that was really good. I guess Kenya, you know, outclassed in the semi-final. Yeah, we've discussed their kind of slide enough times to, you know, not be too surprised that they were, you know, outclassed by Zimbabwe and then outclassed by Uganda again in the bronze medal match. Simon Sazazi in that bronze medal match going well. He's another one at the top of the order who's been pretty good recently. And Cosmas Chiwuta, who's, I believe he was out for injury not too long ago. Good to see him back and firing, and he'll be very important for Uganda looking ahead to the T20 World Cup. But yeah, I mean, that match, the final, Zimbabwe cruised home with 5 overs to spare, chasing 114. I think looking at Namibia, the positives here are probably more on the bowling side. I thought Simon Shikongo, Ben's brother, was pretty good. Bowling his off spin. P.D. Blignaut, another left arm spinner, perhaps, you know, looking to take up the mantle from Bernard Scholtz in not too long. I mean, you never know how long Scholtz is going to stick around. Yeah, I mean, I think Namibia's spin stocks actually look pretty good at the moment, because there's also, obviously, Jan-Nicol Loftie-Eaton, who spins it away from the right-hander, Blignaut, who spins it away from the right-hander. Yeah, Shikongo and Mauritius Inkapeter as well is another one sort of floating around, so they've got a couple of off-spin options as well. So yeah, I think their bowling on the spin side was actually quite encouraging, but the seamers from Namibia, I don't know, they just have this kind of unending production line of interchangeable, yeah, sort of medium pace all-rounders. I mean, none of them are bad exactly, but none of them are really showing that kind of cutting edge that you would want to be considered a frontline bowler. You know, they've got, it's like the old joke about New Zealand, you know, back in the early 2000s, where they had sort of five or six guys who could bat seven or eight and bowl third or fourth change. And they've got a lot of guys like that in Namibia at the moment, which no one's really sort of putting their hand up to become a new member of the pace attack in the same way as there's a lot of sort of positive developments with the spin. But yeah, so I think it was definitely a worthwhile outing for them. The batting, yeah, I mean, they were missing a lot of their senior players, but you know, you could say probably Loftie-Eaton would be a bit disappointed with his outing, and Malang Kruger was okay. Nico Davin didn't do that much. So you know, when your two senior guys are not performing, that puts a lot of pressure on the junior guys who haven't had as much experience. And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of guys who you probably could have experimented with who weren't involved here either. You know, we haven't seen Lowen Lawrence for a while. We haven't seen Piki Jafrens for a while. So, you know, even kind of fringe guys like that would have been worth having a look at, I think. But overall, a good tournament, good outing for a lot of these teams. Uganda, as I mentioned, Alpesh Ramjani, almost forgot to mention, he was basically unplayable, went at something like 4 and over or, you know, something ridiculous, and picked up a bunch of wickets. So yeah, I mean, I think a positive outing overall for Uganda, but you know, maybe they'll have some question marks. They just got really bogged down in that semi-final against Namibia. They just couldn't get the ball away, chasing a pretty low target. You know, they needed to get 112 in their 20 overs, and they just couldn't get the ball off the square, basically. They really struggled. I mean, it was the kind of situation where, you know, once you get bogged down and then you sort of start looking to hit those, you know, more aggressive shots to try and catch up, and it sort of snowballed. But overall, I mean, yeah, very entertaining tournament. I really enjoyed watching some of it on the streams. The time zone was pretty good for Europe. I liked this tournament. It's just a shame that the sort of status nonsense kind of became the story, and rather than an entertaining tournament with some fun little bits of trivia like South Africa losing to Kenya. And I don't know, yeah, it does just sort of leave a bit of a bad taste in the mouth that, you know, that kind of became the story.
Another sad story or event, I suppose, but it's one where we can look back and celebrate, is the career of Colin Dumbuya. Mm-hmm. And we saw the tributes of several people on Twitter, both, you know, associate cricket fans, but also some of his former opposition and teammates. He announced it basically in an interview straight after their defeat against Uganda. I think the biggest credit or plaudit you can give Colin Dumbuya is that some of his, you know, fiercest opposition over the years, particularly in Africa and regional cricket, and then at World Cups, many of them turn around and express their gratitude to Collins, who, you know, by all reports is an excellent figure of Kenyan and African cricket. And I can safely say, as someone who developed their real love for associate cricket at sort of the turn of the millennium and the early 2000s, he was a name that came up a lot, especially when Kenya was so strong when they were and had to live through the slide of Kenyan cricket in so many ways. And his cricket almost is a kind of testament to sort of his perseverance in the game and Kenya's perseverance as a cricketing country. Was more of a leg spinner when he sort of came through, then developed his batting and then, you know, became quite a reliable Kenyan batter who then bowled a little bit. Had a career in England as well, played at Warwickshire. I think talking to a few people around the cricket archives of the world and looking at old World Cricket League systems, you know, he would have played against over 40 opposition internationally in a career that probably went back as far as, say, you know, the mid-90s. We know that his one-day international career is only from 2001 onwards. And of course, you know, that's when you sort of factor that S word again, status in all of this. But
his first senior match was in 2000 against a Pakistan touring team in a first class status.
Yeah, even then, you know, it's just James Anderson now who is the final cricketer from the 2003 Cricket World Cup who is still active as a player, which goes to show that the longevity of Colin Dumbuya's career, bowing out, you know, in his, what, he would be 43 this year. Just an incredible career. And probably a little bit unfair for him that, you know, Kenya found themselves in, I suppose, some really dark and low moments in international cricket after, you know, they lost one day international status at one point there. I think that was it was 2014, wasn't it, when they lost one day international status. But, you know, has been through the highs and lows, was there when Kenya were at their brightest and stuck around even when things weren't as gleamy and bright. But an unbelievable figure in associate cricket and someone that I think we would have a lot of respect for in our community as well.
Yeah, fantastic career from a guy who, as you say, started off as a leg spinner, broke onto the scene with a 5-wicket haul in that 2003 World Cup, and then yeah, for a couple of years after that, he really struggled with bowling and just couldn't get his rhythm back and sort of faded away as a leg spin prospect. He was dedicated to Kenyan cricket, so he worked on his batting, did a bit of a George Dockrell, I guess you could say, and worked on his batting, and then came back as a very reliable batter for them. I believe he ends up being Kenya's highest T20I run scorer. Someone can fact check me on that, but I think that's the case. Played a lot of his cricket at the top of the order, which is tough, especially for a guy who's well into his 40s and maybe the reflexes aren't quite there. But yeah, always contributing, even in this tournament, three consecutive half centuries against South Africa, Ghana, and Zimbabwe. Although, unfortunately, only one of those will count on his official record, which that's a bit disappointing. But good career, just a great servant of the game in Kenya. As you allude to, he stuck around through some pretty turbulent times. It's the last one of the 2003 Golden Generation. Really kind of speaks to looking to the future. Where do they go now that they don't have someone like him sort of holding things down at the top of the order? I don't see many of the. I mean, I guess we can look at the under 19 series that Kenya is playing against Uganda a bit later. But yeah, I think Collins Mbuya has been instrumental in a lot of people like us, getting into cricket. Seeing him at the 2003 World Cup with Kenya and their amazing run into the semi-finals, that really ignited my love of the game. Obviously alongside John Davison smashing the West Indies around, but I think it's just part of the rich fabric of the game that he's been around for so long, and it is a bit of a shame. It is always sad seeing guys that you've grown up watching retiring, and there's fewer and fewer of them around
Yeah,
these days.
we're
So
getting old now too, Nick, I'll say.
yeah, now we're getting on. We're getting to the point where we'd be retiring from
Whoa, whoa,
international
whoa, whoa!
cricket.
Speak for yourself. We're not if we're Collins Abuya, and
Well, no, that's
yeah.
true. We've Tim's. Yeah, is Collins Mbuya older than Tim?
Yes, just.
Right, so we've got a few years left in us.
Yeah, exactly. I'll immigrate to a far-flung part of the earth and help their international career grow.
St. Helena. But yeah, hell of a career, hell of a career, and we wish him all the best in future. And quite a few of those Kenyan guys have gone on to do good things in the coaching sphere. Obviously,
Yeah.
we know Steve Tsakola's had a lot of success, so we wish him well in his future endeavours, and hopefully he can give back to the Kenyan game because they certainly need it.
Yeah, Jimmy Kamande is at the in the Tanzanian setup, which helped them on the way to the Cricket World Cup Challenge League. And while we do thank Collins Abuya for his service in the game, we hope to see him pick up maybe a coaching role or something similar. Anything within cricket, that'd be great. When we do bring up Tanzania and Kenya, they are two teams that will compete, of course, in the next Challenge League cycle together on the same level after Tanzania were one of the four teams to be promoted. And as we do record, the Challenge League groups have just dropped. We've got the two groups of six on the path to Cricket World Cup 2027. Of course, this is effectively the third tier of 50-over international cricket, and worth getting your pen and paper writing down these groups to everyone at home. But Group A, Papua New Guinea, Jersey, Kuwait, Qatar, Kenya, and Denmark. And Group B, Hong Kong, Uganda, Bahrain, Italy, Tanzania, and Singapore. Now, just eyeballing these groups, and with the fierce competition that we did see in the Challenge League playoff, especially teams entering from coming in with that T20I rankings just below as the challenges for the Challenge League, the likes of Kuwait and Bahrain and Tanzania as well, who were so good at the Challenge League playoff, it makes this competition arguably fiercer than it was than the previous cycle. I mean, you could probably make the case that Malaysia were a strong side to miss out, but they only miss out because there's quite a few teams moving into this sphere that I think could well and truly continue their rise up the divisions, looking at the groups. And I suppose we'll talk about the potential locations of legs for these particular groups in a second, but we've only just sort of seen these, Nick, at the time of recording. And I'm looking at the groups, and it's very hard to pick winners. We know PNG have come down from League Two, but we know that that's a team that is desperate to find some form in the 50-over game. And Asad Vala is a man who's not getting any younger himself. as the captain of this PNG team. They're looking to try and find some new blood, although they have created a little bit of depth in the last few years. But yeah, again, just eyeballing these groups, I don't really see clear favourites. I mean, maybe Uganda in Group B, but even still, there's a lot of competition in that group too. PNG will have their work cut out. Jersey were a good side in the last rotation, as were Kenya, Qatar as well as a team that could challenge. And yeah, the teams coming up from the playoff are all capable of causing an upset on their day as well. So, I mean, outside of maybe Singapore, we feel has dropped in class over the last 2 years or so in Group B. I don't really see a clear favourite here. And if I was a gambling man, Nick, I'd have no idea where I'd want to put my money here. Maybe, just maybe, PNG and Uganda to top each group. But there are the top two going through to the Cricket World Cup qualifier playoff as well. So there is an extra incentive for these teams, these 2 6-team groups. You know, you've only got to finish in the top two to gain a place. And it's open, but purely because it's how tough it is and how collectively tough the groups are, that I think we can make a case for any one of these teams almost to go through.
Yeah, that point you made about there being two slots open to go up into the playoff at the end of the cycle, that's a very intriguing one because that certainly opens it up. You know, you look at last cycle's results and there wasn't a whole lot separating a lot of these teams. You know, Uganda only just missed out on net run rate to Jersey, and, you know, obviously Canada stomped Group A of the Challenge League, and, you know, they're doing quite well in League 2 at the moment. So I think Canada were definitely a class above. But, you know, below them in Group A, Denmark and Qatar finished equal on points as well. And then, yeah, Singapore only just behind, although most of that was in sort of from the first half. They've really fallen away significantly. And yeah, I mean, Group B, Hong Kong were not too far behind Uganda and Jersey. They were pretty good in the Challenge League as well. So a lot of teams here probably can make a very good case for going up at the end of the cycle. You know, Tanzania and Bahrain, the two teams who came into the Challenge League, ending up in the same group is kind of interesting, but they both looked very strong in their campaign to qualify. So, yeah, I mean, I think, as you say, Singapore's really the only obvious weak link in Group B. And then in Group A, I mean, you sort of, by default, you would say that PNG dropping down from League 2 would be a favourite. But then in the World Cup qualifier playoff, Jersey beat PNG for Jersey's first ever ODI win, that huge partnership between Asa Tribe and Lawrence Stevenson. So PNG go into Group A with a 0-1 record against Jersey. So where does Denmark and Qatar come here again? Kenya, I don't know. I mean, I think they were a bit behind the pace, although they were dangerous for sure last cycle. So I think maybe if you're looking to separate these groups, yeah, I think Kenya probably will struggle to compete. And then Kuwait are another new team as well. So we've got a lot of these, the Gulf teams starting to dominate the next level in the pathway, which is just another testament to the strength of the game in the region. But yeah, I mean, I agree. As you say, I think it's very difficult to pick at all at this point. And it'll be interesting to see who hosts because, you know, just kind of eyeballing it in Group A. PNG, I don't think have enough facilities. Jersey certainly do. Kuwait and Qatar, we're not sure. Qatar have at least one very good facility, but I don't know if they have multiple ones. Kenya have enough facilities. Denmark certainly don't. And then Group B, yeah, Hong Kong, Uganda, Italy, Singapore, Tanzania. I mean, I think these teams could all host. And yeah, Bahrain, I just don't know. So Group B has more hosting potential. So that'll be interesting as well. But yeah, a couple of very, very tight groups and should be another couple of years of exciting cricket. I'm looking forward to it.
A little birdie has told me that the three locations in Group B will be Uganda, Tanzania, and Hong Kong. We thought Hong Kong might have a little bit of trouble just on the basis of the dimensions of grounds, the second ground that they would have to use, because you would assume that Mission Road is fine. The other one, what they do if it's in Kowloon, for instance, we're not too sure. But
we could be seeing some six hitting records.
We could be seeing a lot of kookaburras lost into the bushes or in the buildings next door. But you know, that you could make the case that really helps the likes of Uganda and Tanzania, because, you know, they're two sort of facilities and two countries that know each other very well. We know that Uganda could make a case for being one of the favorites in that group anyway, but Yeah, looking forward to that. We haven't got any leg details as such thus far. But yeah, again, looking forward to the new Challenge League cycle. Let's move on. Well, some cricket that's not happening is through Ireland. Now
This is happening a lot, isn't it?
Their Wolves team are in Nepal, and that's great. And they've moved some matches there to accommodate for the rain that they've had, which is brilliant because they're looking to find ways to put cricket on. It seems though, as if in Ireland they're trying to find excuses not to play cricket, which to me, it goes to show just how broken Ireland's current financial model is. At the moment, it looks as if Scotland are going to take hosting rights of Australia off Ireland when Australia do travel to that part of the world. But look, it's been on the administrative side for Ireland, it's been tough over the last few years. They had the hacking situation where they lost a bucket load of money, but it seems as though there's been no push from that. There's seemingly not a whole lot going on in terms of being able to organize international cricket with the funds that they do have. There's talk of doing up Malahide, which to be honest is a little bit head scratching because, you know, they're struggling to put up cricket as it is. There's people on a lot of money in Cricket Ireland at the moment as well. Nick, does any of this compute to you? Because it, as full members, it feels like Ireland have struggled ever since they actually took full membership, which kind of makes you ask the question, you know, do people really want full membership of the ICC at the moment if this is how they're going to be? Because there's obviously a clear problem here if a full member of the ICC cannot fund their own cricket at the moment, whether it be through the ICC funding model that we know could probably be a little bit better, but it doesn't seem like Afghanistan has the same issue, although they're not hosting international cricket actually in Afghanistan, but they are footing the bill of matches in UAE. What's going on?
Well, I mean, Afghanistan is a whole topic we can leave
another
for
pod, please. We'll be here all night and I'm on holiday.
Yeah. we don't need to get into that can of worms. But yeah, I mean, fundamentally, what is the point of Cricket Ireland if they're not organising cricket for Ireland to play? So yeah, it is kind of bizarre that there was a funny graph floating around on Irish cricket Twitter basically showing their sort of financial situation and the only year that they made a profit was 2020 when they cancelled everything. So what does that say? Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is somewhat understandable in the sense that, you know, the hosting cricket is quite expensive and, you know, there's some specific issues to Ireland, Dublin especially, which I can actually relate to a lot in Reykjavik, in that it's a pretty small town, and you know, a lot of the sort of hotels and accommodation industry has just skyrocketed, and it is very expensive to host people and, you know, to find bookings for a visiting team. You know, that's a fair issue. But, you know, I mean, there's ways you can get around that. You know, you could host them in Northern Ireland. It's like an hour or maybe like 90 minutes. I've done the trip on the bus. It's really not difficult. It is, you know, cost of living is a bit cheaper in Northern Ireland. You could play the matches in Northern Ireland. You could host them in, you know, somewhere in England and then, you know, drive them. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot you could do. So, yeah, that kind of, it's understandable on one level, but that sort of stuff, it just seems like they're not really trying. I mean, more broadly, what does it say about cricket in Ireland if they can't, you know, make their money back hosting the World Champions? That's kind of a real worry if that's the issue there as well. I mean, yeah, you mentioned the email hacking scam, whatever it was. I don't know. I mean, where is the money going though? Have they been in contact with another Nigerian prince? It doesn't add up, because they do get a decent amount of money from the ICC, and yes, they have a lot of operating costs now, but at the same time, you know, they're not hosting domestic three-day cricket. The Interpros is kind of on pause still. You know, that was certainly a drain on expenses. You know, hosting Australia, one of the complaints is, oh, you know, we'll need to bring in the temporary stands and that's really expensive. And I mean, but why not just play it without the temporary stands? I mean, I don't know. There's a lot of things that kind of don't add up, and it just seems like, yeah, like what are they doing with this money? There was some stories a few years, well, over the last few years of Cricket Ireland kind of getting rid of a lot of like regional development work. And I don't know. Are they, where is that money going? It's just, yeah, it's very strange. I think there's quite a lot of office staff, like compared to other sort of comparable boards, which, again, what are they doing? Where's this money going? It, I don't know. Something isn't really stacking up for me here. And yeah, I mean, Warren Jutram, I understand why they are loyal to him, and he certainly did a lot to bring Ireland this far and into full membership. And, you know, for a while, that partnership with Jutram and Trent Johnston was one of the most dynamic in associate cricket at the time. But yeah, I don't know. I just kind of feel it's probably time for him to move on and bring in someone with, you know, maybe a fresh perspective on the organisation. I don't know. Yeah, it's a kind of thing where you want to thank someone for their service and you know, very politely move them on. But if they don't want to move on, then that becomes very difficult. Yeah, I mean, but if Scotland, on the other hand, if they've managed to, you know, pull this off and grab the series against Australia, that's a hell of a coup for them. And again, it raises questions. If, you know, Scotland, pretty comparable, you know, economy and cricket scene and all of that, on a fraction of the budget, if they can manage to host a series against Australia, what are Ireland doing? Yeah, something really just doesn't make sense here.
No, I haven't got a whole lot to add, but having listened to interviews with Warren Jutram in the past, he really was, at least at one stage, the gold standard of cricket leadership in this space. You know, Ireland moved a lot in large part due to, yeah, as you say, him and the work of many of the players over the years as well. They achieved a lot with the resources that they had. We know that they fulfilled a lot of the requirements to be full members, and then they were eventually granted that status. And we know that those guidelines are just that, sort of guidelines of what the requirements actually are is always grey, but they dotted I's, crossed all the T's for a long time there, and were the hallmark of what made it a great international side at this level. And then we saw the sheer speed of growth in Afghanistan by contrast, and they did it a little bit differently. But Ireland is a great, I suppose, template for what associates can do to move into that space. But now they've kind of reached a point of stagnation, and I think the timing of COVID didn't help either, as we mentioned as well. So hopefully we do get some more positive news. As we said as well, Ireland Wolves touring Nepal, and we'll talk about that tour a little bit more when it is finished and completed. But as we noted at the top of the show, they actually accommodated matches to be put back in the schedule a little bit more because of the rain that they had in Kathmandu and in Kirtipur earlier in the tour. So good to see that there was a bit of proactivity in all of that. A couple of news stories, I suppose, before we hit our final point. Namibia women have been awarded central contracts for the first time, which is good to see. And we've seen the Women's Asia Cup randomly being expanded. Now, what we thought was going on in the competitions building up to this tournament on the qualifying side was that UAE had taken that spot with Malaysia taking the spot over Nepal. It now looks as though all of those teams are actually in, and the competition has expanded to 8 teams. We were a little bit taken aback, but I suppose it's a good thing seeing this tournament expanded. It won't be played until July. We'll talk about the Namibia women's contracts in a second, but first this point, Nick, you could almost look at it on both sides. You know, would things have changed or been a little bit different if the qualifying process was done knowing that there were going to be 8 teams in this tournament? I don't know, but I think the two teams that come in, Nepal and Thailand, are two obviously good teams in this region, and I think the tournament is better for having them in. So overall, I think play on. I think this is a good decision in the end.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit strange. It reminds me of World Cricket League Division 2, sort of almost 10 years ago. Two teams were supposed to go up, but then Nepal finished fourth, and then mysteriously it was expanded to 4 teams going up. I don't know if that's what's happening here as well. You know, they're trying to get the Nepali eyeballs. But if associate cricket in Asia can ride on, you know, the Nepali eyeball coattails, I think it's worth doing. And yeah, I mean, pretty lucky for Thailand and Nepal, who had pretty disappointing campaigns in the qualifier. But yeah, I mean, I'm not really ever going to complain too much at adding more teams, especially more associate teams, to a tournament. So yeah, good for them. Bit weird that it's happened like this, but you know, more teams is better.
Yeah, that women's tournament is a few months away in the middle of the year. I think that June. I think it's in July actually. That period. So looking forward to that. And yeah, the more the merrier, I guess. On the Namibian women being awarded their first central contracts, It's come at a time where we've seen the continued growth of cricket in this part of the world. They've been able to, I think, work off the back of the success of the men's team, and it's starting to kind of trickle down across both men's and women's cricket, where they can both kind of enjoy the success and build on their game. We know this is probably it's a watershed moment for Namibia, because I think we mentioned last week or on the last show that Namibia are close to pushing this region in terms of its growth and its achievements on the field. They just haven't been able to, I suppose, break through and take that tournament win and really grab this region by the scruff of the neck. But something like this, where, you know, the cricketers can treat this more as a full-time job, or at least compete and play cricket on a full-time basis, I think only bodes well for them. And I think, again, it's an indication that this region will only continue its cricket. We see a lot of women's international cricket already, and through Kubuka and just a hotbed of talent that we've seen. But the availability of a lot of these Namibian players was more than likely dependent on whether or not they could get out of work. And now there's a good chance that they'll be able to play on a full-time basis. This might just be the catalyst of some Namibia achievement on the women's side, Nick.
Yeah, you'd hope so. An interesting little tidbit is that this move will make Cricket Namibia the first sporting body in the country to have professional contracts for men and women. So that's a good development. And I think it speaks to the role that women's cricket can and is playing in promoting the game around the world, that, you know, it's an opportunity for the game to really position itself as a leading sport for women and girls. And I think that's a great move from Namibia. And, you know, referring back to the discussion about Cricket Ireland, I mean, Namibia, yes, you know, a dollar from the ICC goes further in Namibia than it does in Ireland, but at the same time, you know, the amount of money that they get is significantly less. So, you know, the fact that they can afford this, I know, yeah, it's only 10 contracts, so, you know, not even a full team, but, you know, it's a start, and it's a huge step forward. I think, yeah, as you refer to, a lot of the time they are not necessarily playing their best 11 because people are unavailable. You know, you think back last year, Wilka Mwatile was away because she had to do some stuff related to her nursing qualification. So being able to have both the Mwatile sisters available, you know, full time, a bunch of the other star players that are sort of, you know, not necessarily in the team every time, that will help a lot. So yeah, great development. Hopefully it improves the team overall. It'll be interesting to see who is awarded contracts and all of that sort of stuff, but yeah, hopefully it helps Namibia break into the sort of the race along with Scotland and UAE for, you know, you talked about whether teams want full membership. I think they still very much do. Ireland is kind of an outlier, I think, in the sense that having that extra funding, it's not necessarily helped them, but that's more sort of a self-inflicted problem rather than, you know, boards that are quite well run in other parts of the world. But yeah. Good news from Namibia, and hopefully their women's team can keep improving.
Some final news, or should we say fake news? We got kind of caught in the crossfires a little bit with all of this, actually, which I found quite funny and probably the reason why it sort of came across our desk. But we saw Greg Barclay visit Nepal on an ICC visit. And these visits are kind of, how do I put this? They're for reasons different to what I suppose the fans and the general public think. So for someone like Greg Barclay going over to Nepal, it's basically just a sort of a dignitary visit and just to ensure that things are going well in that part of the world from an administrative standpoint, given that, you know, we have seen Nepal suspended in the past, and the ICC's worked in direct consultation with people in Nepal to ensure that the governing body is run fairly and adhering to the requirements that it needs to adhere to. Of course, you can't have any sort of governmental interference. He then came out and gave a bit of an interview, or sort of a press conference, and there were a few quotes that were misconstrued and ultimately false in how he went about them. He talked about, well, he supposedly talked about two new full members in 2027, and then talked about ICC organizing tours between Nepal and full members. Now, it doesn't take very long for you to work out that working out and organizing tours outside of global events are not ICC's responsibility, They all come under the sort of Future Tours program and things surrounding of that nature, as well as an associate Future Tours program that actually came out this year, which we'd never really seen in the past. And the quote in regards to potential full members and one of them being Nepal turned out to be untrue. And we kind of got caught in the crossfires with this because, you know, we basically said, look, don't shoot the messenger, but this is not a correct quote. And then a lot of people came at us and was just like, oh, you're not happy about Nepal's development in the game. And I mean, quite frankly, it was...
It's been a while since we've had some Why You Hate Nepal.
It's really odd, and it just proves that no one listens to us talking about this anyway, so it's probably futile. But there was some other news in Nepal. The tender for the floodlights at the TU ground got knocked back again, which is a bit disappointing because I think we all want to see the TU under lights.
Yeah.
I think that ground would... You know what? I think one of the benefits of that ground actually having the lights is not just it being a spectacle, but because you don't have to worry about the morning dew that just seems to just dictate that game of cricket every time they go there. Anyway, that's not the point that we want to sort of bring up. But the era of fake news has well and truly hit cricket. And there was one strange tweet where we got accused of not changing cricket as journalists. And it's like, well, man, it's not our job. Jeez, if it was our job, cricket would look a lot different than what it is now.
Well, if only we had that power.
I wish we had as much control as some people on Twitter seem to think we have.
Yeah.
We're talking about how we're filling our boots with money because we licked the boots of our home boards. It's like, CA is not a good board. Like, what CA do does not parallel with what I want international cricket to be. Full disclosure, Nick, I know that's not exactly breaking news, but I mean, it's important to get your facts right. And that's why emerging cricket exists as well, because, you know, there's a lot of hearsay and a lot of he said, she said, but I mean, when it comes down to it, like, you can't just manifest something into it happening. You can't just tweet out into existence, two full new members will happen in 2027 because someone said this. One, it wasn't ever said. And two, you can't just make it up and hope that it happens. I mean, we've seen enough speculation in the emerging game, and I think we're dimmed to it enough and desensitized to this enough to know, Nick, you and I, you know, to be cynical and to believe things when you see a ball being bowled. You know, I remember when Ireland won its full membership and that test match happened against Pakistan. I mean, one, it rained on the first day in Malahide and we're like, is this really happening right now? Like, I won't believe this full membership's happening until I see the first ball bowled and a match being played, which is like any news of a positive note that we have about emerging cricket, like that Asia Cup on the women's side expanding to 8 teams. Great, we didn't expect it, but now that it's here, that's awesome. But you can't just sit here and just make up rumours and hope that they will magically manifest in 3-4 years' time. It's not how the world works.
If only. But there's a lot to unpack there. I guess the broader point is going back to what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, the ICC as an institution really is pretty powerless. So even if Greg Barclay had said, you know, the quotes that he supposedly said,
they don't mean anything.
Greg Barclay doesn't have the authority to do that.
No.
Like, he can't just create two new full members. It needs to be approved by the other existing full members, which is where all the power lies at the ICC. So there's that point. I mean, I think, to be fair, I think there's probably, I don't know, maybe an element of language barrier and someone kind of misunderstood what he was saying.
No, definitely.
A bit of a sort of Chinese whispers situation where it got passed between a few people and, you know, people maybe sort of heard what they wanted to hear kind of thing. So, yeah, I don't think it was malicious. I think it was just a misunderstanding, but
it turned malicious when they didn't like what they heard the clarification to be.
Yeah, and that's, yeah, it is disappointing. I don't know. I mean, if only we were able to, you know, fill our pockets talking about associate cricket.
We'd be the richest people in the world. Do you know how many podcasts we've done?
Yeah, well, exactly.
This is literally EC Pod 222.
Oh, yeah, actually, good point. Bringing up the Richie, but nobody gets into associate cricket to get rich. That's been true all along, and unfortunately, it's still true now. But you know, so if any wealthy benefactors want to change that, we're all ears. But at the moment, nobody is making any money from emerging cricket. Really, it's just a case of people needing to check their sources before they start spouting off on Twitter, which is a very big problem in a lot of areas of life.
Oh, we need to bring up one more point, and I'm so glad you just did that. There was one source on Twitter this week who posted a photo, and the source of the photo was internet. And I absolutely laughed up a lung. I mean,
it's
like,
not wrong.
It's not. I mean, it's funny. Like, I just thought that was if it was. I don't think it was meant to be peak banter, but it ended up being peak banter. Anyway, you make a good point. You know, there's a lot of sort of he said, she said, and yeah, I suppose the language barrier does make it a little bit more difficult as well. And we want the game to be as inclusive as we can, but you know, you just can't make up rumors and just expect them to be true and then get angry when someone tells you and clarifies that that's not the case. Anyway, it's a little bit of a personal digression at the end of this podcast. You're my therapy this week, Nick. Thank you for joining me on another Emerging Cricket podcast.
I'll get back on the beach, Beth.
I'll run back to the bar, which I did drag myself from. But thank you for joining me, Nick. And thank you, everyone around the world, for listening to the Emerging Cricket podcast. We've got, as we mentioned, a backlog of content, and we've still got to get through the likes of European Cricket League 2024 and the cricket that's gone on in the last week or so. But yeah, hoping to get some people on and to talk all of that with you. Of course, visit emergingcricket.com for all news in the emerging game, as well as the podcast spots to listen to us, as well as Nate and Aman in the Big Innings pod as well, talking all things USA cricket. Plenty of action with the T20 World Cup around the corner, and of course that being 20 teams. So again, hugely looking forward to all that. But thanks, Nick, and thank you everyone out there. On behalf of Nick Skinner and myself, Daniel Beswick, it's goodbye, and enjoy the rest of your week in the emerging cricket world.